they're shorting the futures market and buying the cash market and the treasuries. Is that correct? Is that what you, I paraphrase that? Okay. That reminds me, correct me if I'm wrong, of long-term capital and the blow up there. So we can potentially see a blow up. It's a ticking time bomb, correct, in the hedge fund world, correct?
Yeah, it's an arbitrage, and it's a leveraged arbitrage, and therefore it corresponds exactly to what long-term capital were doing, even though
Yeah.
they were doing something subtly different, but it's exactly the same.
Oh,
If
God.
it's yellow and quacks, it's a duck, in other words.
They're really picking the winners and the losers in this, correct?
Yep.
Okay. So, and so the second question is really, I mean, is this just like, I don't want to get too political, but is this just like political? Hey, you're my friend, you donated to me, so now I'm going to support the cause? Or, yeah, I mean, where's the danger here, obviously?
Yeah, I think, look, I mean, I wrote a book, I mean, it's about 5 years ago now, called Capital Wars, which was basically looking at the whole idea that there was a struggle for the dominance of capital in the world economy between America and China. And we went through a lot of this liquidity stuff and why, watching global liquidity is important. But the book was really designed to say, look, there's a lot of talk about trade wars, but trade wars are just a veneer here. I mean, you've got to go beneath the surface. And what really matters is capital wars. I would argue they are. And the way to look at that is to look at the yuan gold price. And I think that's the best metric to understand what China's doing here.
There you
So what
go.
they're doing is, broadly speaking, letting the yuan gold price appreciate. Now, given the fact that they're encouraging their citizens to buy lots of gold, is clearly propelling this higher at the same time. But it's giving Chinese investors or residents a big cushion against that monetary inflation.
Yeah.
And what's more, if China backs its currency to some extent by gold, I'm not talking about a gold standard here, that's not what I mean. A gold standard is impossible.
Michael Howell, Cross Border Capital. Good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Very good to be here.
Well,
Lots
it's
going on in markets.
Yeah, there really is. And I'm a big fan, and I'm very honored and grateful to have you on here. Let's jump right into it. Where are we at in this cycle? It's just in the US. I'm only talking here in the US. I'm not familiar with the UK or European markets and issues as much. But we just had another auto loan lender to high interest auto loan just implode. This is, I want to say, the second one in the last week. If you
Yeah.
would, the housing market's slowing down. It seems like we're having a big contraction in liquidity, but what's your opinion on this?
Well, I think we're at the beginnings of a liquidity contraction. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, you've got to recall that we've come up a long way here. Markets have been going up pretty much since late 2022. I mean, almost uninterrupted. I mean, that's a heroic statement, but I mean the trend has been strong. It's been labeled the everything bubble, as you know, and it's made a lot of people a lot of money. The trouble is that things don't go on forever, and we've got to understand that inflections can occur, and that inflection is probably underway now. Certainly there's a fire alarm sounding, and we don't know whether this is the real thing or a test, but we've got to be cognizant of that fact. And where you're seeing deterioration at the margin is really in the repo markets, and the repo markets are critical for our survival. So we need to understand what's going on. And it may be that it's deliberate from the Fed's point of view. It may be complacency, but the reality is that repo rates are spiking, well above Fed funds targets.
Got it. Okay, can you touch briefly on the repo markets? I know what that is and all of that, but I want you, just for all of our viewers and listeners that are not aware of that, what exactly is the repo markets and why is it important?
Yeah, let me just share if I can, let me try and share a presentation. And if I
Please.
do that, I can then go through. Tell me if you see that. Hopefully you can. I'll do from current slide, right? Okay. So let me just wing through here and basically try and show this slide. Now, this may be starting off a little bit wonkishly, but this is really trying to say, look, if you pick up a finance textbook, it's not really going to help you very much in understanding what financial markets are doing and why we're seeing a crisis now, because it's very textbooks are kind of very much out of date, and the world has moved on a lot in the last 10, 15 years, principally since the global financial crisis in 2008. And the reality is that if you look at financial markets today, they're predominantly about debt refinancing. I mean, if you pick up a textbook, it will tell you that a capital market is there to effectively supply finance for a new investment project, whether it's a mine or whether it's a an engineering plant or whatever. And a corporation will basically issue equity or debt accordingly. The reality is that in the modern world, that financial markets are really there to refinance existing debt. And something like 80%, maybe 70 to 80% of all transactions, all primary transactions in financial markets today are about debt refinancing. So what we're looking at is a debt refinancing cycle, and that's really important to understand. Now, what this diagram says is at the heart of the financial system, there is a nexus between debt and liquidity. Okay, now we all know what debt is. What is liquidity? Liquidity is essentially the flow of money through financial markets. So it's another way to think about it is to think about it as the capacity, the balance sheet capacity of credit providers like banks or shadow banks, and they have the ability to do the role of debt. So if someone wants to roll over a debt, they'll go to a credit provider, they'll get extra cash, they'll roll their debt, etc. And that is pretty much how this thing works. Now, if you look at that relationship, the paradox that's at the heart of the financial system today, and largely since the GFC, is that debt needs liquidity for refinancing, but liquidity also needs debt because a lot of liquidity is, or credit, is collateralized. And the left-hand side of this diagram says 77% of global lending is collateral-based. That's a World Bank figure, official figure. So they estimate that the vast majority of liquidity or credit in the world economy is now backed by some form of collateral. Now, that could be something as straightforward as a real estate. So you do a home mortgage, and that's clearly a collateral loan. But more particularly in financial markets, you're looking at government debt, particularly US treasuries, sometimes German bunds, pristine collateral to actually back any borrowing. And what this is really saying is that you've got the repo markets where those transactions occur. So repo is essentially a sale and repurchase. That's what it means. But essentially what you're doing is you're lending a security and you're getting cash back against that security for some term. And that term may be overnight, it may be a few days, it may be longer. But essentially, the repo markets are judging that particular balance. So the balance between debt or collateral and the availability of liquidity. And that's why it's important. Now, let me just say one other thing before I tell you what's going wrong. And that is that, if you look at how most people understand financial markets, it's really to say that, if you're valuing, let's say if you're valuing equities, the most traditional way is to look at things like PE multiples, or if you're a tad more sophisticated, what you do is look at the PE, or effectively the earnings yield of a stock against the bond yield, and look at the yield spread between the two. And so if bond yields start to rise, then equity yields have to rise and the markets come down. And that's the conventional route of analysis. And that's pretty much what that was what we were schooled in, because pension funds, large pension funds and insurance funds that were investing our savings dominated the markets, and they were doing the arbitrage between equities and bonds. The thing is that they've been eclipsed now, and pension funds are not really that big a buyers of risk assets because a lot of them are in rundown. And they're mostly invested in fixed income, and they're effectively coming towards the end of their lives, or traditional pension funds that do 60-40 balanced mandates. And what you've got now is that most of the buying of risk assets is leverage purchase. Okay, so you've got hedge funds who are clearly operating a lot of derivative activity. And what that is rests on is not so much the fixed income markets. And that arbitrage, it rests on the repo markets and the integrity of repo. So in to understand the leverage in the system and the risk, if I'm making sense now, you need to go back to look at the repo markets and the health of the repo markets. And that really is the heartbeat that we've got to look at. Now, if that's, if you like, a basic introduction, then you've got to look at this chart that I'm putting up here, which is looking at that ratio between the stock of debt and the amount of liquidity. Now, everyone will be familiar with the fact that we've got, a massive amount of debt in the world economy, and, basically the world economy has sort of become drunk on excess debt, and governments have issued debt with alacrity, and we know that, and that is clearly a problem. But if you look at the ratio between debt and liquidity, that's really the key metric to understand, because, we can all take on debt, and debt's not a problem. The problem is paying it back. Or more particularly, since, spoiler alert, no one, government's never paid back, they just roll it over. And so what you need is liquidity to roll over the debt. So you need that refinancing ability. And this ratio is telling you the relationship between debt and liquidity. And what it says is that if you're high on that reading on that left-hand scale, which is effectively above the dotted line at 200%, two times, it's saying that when you've got an excessive amount of debt, what you're going to get is a refinancing crisis, okay? Because you can't roll the debt. You haven't got enough liquidity to roll over the debts. And so you get defaults. And effectively, everyone runs scares. They try and liquidate their existing assets. You get a financial crisis. And lo and behold, central banks come in and throw liquidity back at the system. Now, every financial crisis going back in history, I think, certainly in that time frame, back to 1980, has fundamentally been a refinancing crisis. And that's what we want to avoid right now, looking forwards. If you go to the lower part of the chart, it shows there are periods where you've got excessive liquidity relative to debt. And when you've got excessive liquidity, the vent tends to be asset markets and asset bubbles. And so the asset bubbles tend to occur when you've got lots of liquidity and not much debt to refinance. And so that's the avenue where money tends to go. Now, you will see on the lower right-hand side a label called the everything bubble, which is what people, flippantly call the current period that we've been in for the last 10 years or so. And that is really the result of two things. One of those is that every crisis has been met by policymakers issuing or pumping more liquidity back into the system. So whether that's the GFC, where they bailed out the banks, or whether it's COVID, where they just pumped in lots of cash, whatever it is, their solution is more liquidity. And that's clearly helped. The other thing that's coincided with that is that certainly in COVID and arguably before, they decided to put interest rates down to near zero. Now, the question about that, or the problem with that, is that zero interest rates clearly encourage people to take out more debt. So it may be a short-term palliative, but it's a long-term problem. It creates a long-term problem. And I used to work at Salomon Brothers, the US investment bank, and Salomon Brothers used to sort of school people with a textbook, which was called The History of Interest Rates by Sidney Homer. And that book covered 4,000 years of interest rate history in the world economy. And nowhere in those pages is there any reference at all to zero interest rates. Never happened before. So this is how anomalous the last few years have been. And that period of zero interest rates that policymakers decided upon encouraged a lot of borrowers, not surprisingly, not only to take out more debt, but to term out their existing debt into the latter years of this decade. So they were rolling debt over at very low interest rates, and it's due to come back into the system from about 26, 27, 28, 29. And that's largely why that orange line starts to go up so steeply, because that debt's coming back into the system. And hence you'll see that by rights, we should be seeing more tensions emerging in markets. And just for the record, this is the scale of the annual debt roll, the change in the annual debt roll. So the actual debt roll is probably about 30 trillion a year. But you've got to add on to that these increments each year that are coming through because of the terming out of debt. And you can see the sort of the hole in the or the negative bars around 21, 22, 23, which was the COVID years. And then those dark red areas are our estimates of what's coming back. So this is the problem that we're facing. You've got, number one, a lot of debt to refinance, which is clearly going to worry the refinancing markets. But the other thing is you've also got liquidity, which is starting to be constrained. Now, So you've got two sides here. One is an increase in debt, and the other is a drop in liquidity. So that's why this ratio goes up so much. Now, if we come back to liquidity and the cycle, let me just show you a couple of other points, and I'm just going to wing back in this presentation. Now, liquidity, and we show it here in terms of weekly liquidity since middle of 2021. This is the a dollar estimate of the total amount of money that is flowing through global financial markets. So it's not money supply, M2. That's money in retail banks, retail deposits, if you like, of in high street banks. And that's not really what we're measuring here. We're measuring the flow of money through financial markets, which is a very different aggregate. And what this is basically demonstrating is that since the low point in late 2022, liquidity has been on a tear upwards. I mean, it's been, jumped around a couple of times, but generally that trend has been compelling. And we've moved up from just over $155 trillion to now very close to $190 trillion. So it's a big increase over that period. And more recently, through this year, you can see that there's been a big increase in liquidity, and that's clearly helped markets enormously. The problem is that that's going to come to an end at some time, some stage. And if you look at this chart, which is looking at a momentum indicator, it says daily liquidity. It's actually a now cast of what's going on daily through various computer screenings we do. You can see that orange line, which is basically saying, look, we look as if we're inflecting now. The growth rate is starting to come down quite noticeably, and this has got to be a warning of things are tightening. The dotted line, I wouldn't worry too much about. That's just looking at companion measures of market depth, but in other words, bid-ask spreads in markets, so it's a bit more technical. But the orange line is very clearly coming down. Now, the $64,000 question is why is that coming down, and what's the driver? And if we, first of all, look at, before answering that, look at the perspective. This is the global liquidity cycle, the black line, which is that same data, the daily data you just saw, but actually looked at monthly now, going all the way back to 1965. And this is the flow momentum of the flow of liquidity through world financial markets over that time frame. The sine wave that we put on top of that is illustrating a repeating pattern. That repeating pattern tends to be a 5 to 6 year cycle, and that is the average tenor of debt in the world economy. So this really aligns with the idea this is a debt refinancing cycle. And it bottomed at the end of 2022, as we see there, exactly as the sine wave suggested. And we reckon it's slated to peak sometime in late 2025. And it looks like the latest reading, which is end September, is kind of doing that. But we don't know. As I said, we can hear the fire alarm. We don't know whether there's a test or whether this is the real thing. But if you look at what the Fed is doing, I'm going to shift on here to looking at what the Fed is up to. If you look at what the Fed is, sorry, look at what the Fed is up to, this is the growth rate of Fed liquidity. Now, Fed liquidity is not global liquidity, it's a smaller part, but it's clearly very, very important. And what this chart is basically illustrating is the growth rate of Fed liquidity. This is measuring the amount of cash injections, excuse me, that the Federal Reserve makes into markets on a weekly basis. Now, it's not the Fed balance sheet. The Fed balance sheet is not a good measure of liquidity. This is the liquidity creating components of the Fed balance sheet, in other words. Now, you can see there that if you go back to 2021, at the start of the graph, when we were in COVID, Fed liquidity was growing at the peak at well over 80%. Okay, this is 6 month annualized rates of change. So it was really going for it. And then through the back end of 2021 into 2022, the Fed hit the brakes. Okay, they started to, move away from the idea that inflation was transitory, and they began to squeeze quite hard. Now, a lot of what the Fed is doing is beneath the surface. It's not on the surface, such as interest rate hikes or cuts. It's movements in the components of its balance sheet, which you see here. And that period of monetary tightness in 22, excuse me, was basically instrumental in causing a sell-off on Wall Street. Risk assets performed really badly. Come late 22, they injected liquidity back again. Through 23, there was healthy growth, and 24, there was a bit of an air pocket at the back end of 24, and then markets came off through that period. And then through early 25, there was a growth again, largely because of the debt ceiling, which was imposed. And then we see more recently another drop in the growth of the Fed balance sheet, largely because the TGAA, Treasury General Account at the Federal Reserve, has been rebuilt with cash. So they've withdrawn liquidity from markets. And that's taken about $600 billion out of US money markets. And you can see the projection we've made through the middle of 26, which is saying that actually the Fed balance sheet, or sorry, not Fed balance sheet, the Fed liquidity declines by probably on average another 10%. So these are meaningful numbers. Now, what does that mean? Well, the answer is that if you then say, well, what does that mean? First thing it means is that bank reserves will start to fall. And what this chart here is illustrating is the orange line is reserves held at US banks. So you can see that the latest data illustrates a drop, which is what I've labeled there the TGA rebuild. I mean, this is getting into the weeds a bit, but this is directly what's happening. And the red dotted line is what we think the banks need as a minimum or adequate level for reserves. I mean, this is what they
Wow, there's a gap there.
Yeah, there's a big gap, and you can see the
Huge gap.
projection. It's wide. Now, what happens if you get a gap between the amount of liquidity the banks and the money markets need and what you actually get is you start to see this happening. And this is the problem. So what you've got is an imbalance in the repo markets where you're getting a lack of liquidity, which is causing these spikes. Now, what this chart is looking at is the difference between Fed funds rate and SOFR rates. So that's system overnight funding rate. And what that's illustrating, and I wouldn't put, excessive weight on the size of the jumps. I mean, these things can be, very non-linear because very small changes can cause scrambles for cash. It's much more the frequency. And if this is someone, if this is a heartbeat of a patient, I mean, what you're looking at here is, they're approaching the coronary point. You've got a lot of stress coming through. Now, the Fed seems to acknowledge this fact. I mean, Jay Powell 10 days ago said, okay, we're going to stop that. De facto, we're going to stop QT. Well, that's clearly one tick, but they're not really that inclined to restart a QE, and I think they have to do that. And one of the reasons they've got to do that is shown in this chart. And this is looking at the excess or deficient reserves of banks. So it's simply that difference, if you like, that we saw before between the dotted red line and the orange line. So that's just charted there as the orange line in this case. And the black line is measured on the right-hand side, which is showing trade fails among primary dealers, and it's inverted. So a very low reading on the black line is actually a very high level of trade fails. And what you can see is that as liquidity starts to drop, so the number of trade fails on that right-hand axis start to skyrocket. Now, if you get trade fails, what does that really mean? It means that the primary dealers are basically they haven't got the liquidity, or someone is failing to deliver the collateral, and you start to get volatility in the underlying fixed income markets. And that's a problem. And it's a problem which the Federal Reserve itself has alluded to, because in a recent research paper, which they, hasn't got a lot of, strangely, not a lot of publicity, Fed researchers said that what's really important for the US Treasury market, which is clearly the most important financial market worldwide, is that hedge funds are the marginal buyers of treasuries. And hedge funds basically are doing what is called a basis trade between cash treasuries and futures. So they're selling the futures and buying the cash treasuries. The Fed said that that particular transactional, that those flows, last year amounted to $1.5 trillion. So
Gosh.
this is big. And
Gosh.
as
Go
we
ahead.
know, hedge funds heard, there's a survival instinct, and there's a narrow door to get through, and they're all going to rush for the exit at once. So this is kind of perilous in a sense if it starts to get worse. Now, it may not get worse. I mean, let's not, unnecessarily cry wolf. But the fact is that we've got to be very alert to these risks. And what you're seeing is, I think, not a particularly great picture. Now, why is the Federal Reserve not so worried? And the Federal Reserve is less worried because they have, or they believe that that red dotted line should not be drawn where I've drawn it. They think it should be drawn at about 2.7, or in other words, 2,700 on this axis, 2.7 trillion dollars. So in other words, they still believe that the market, the banks have got excess reserves. But I don't think that's the case because it's not showing up in the data, and it's definitely not showing up in terms of the repo markets. So everything I look at tells me the banks are still short of liquidity, and they need to get liquidity put into the system.
Okay, so there is a lot of questions with that, and I've written them down. But first question comes to mind. Well, what you just said, hedge funds, if you would, they're shorting the futures bar market and buying the cash market and treasuries. Is that correct? Is that what you, I paraphrase that? Okay. That reminds me, correct me if I'm wrong, of long-term capital and the blow up there. So we can potentially see a blow up. It's a ticking time bomb, correct, in the hedge fund world, correct?
It's an arbitrage, and it's a leveraged arbitrage, and therefore it corresponds exactly to what long-term capital were doing, even though they were doing something subtly different. But it's exactly the same.
Oh,
If
God.
it's yellow and quacks, it's a duck, in other words.
So that leads to, I'm not laughing. I'm just laughing at the, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing at the absurdity and the risk of it all, if you would, because I lived through long-term capital as you did. The second question is, can the Fed just start, I mean, can they, Fed, Treasury, whoever, I believe they're working lockstep with each other. Can they just start printing a bunch of money to provide the liquidity? And why wouldn't they do that? And I'm not, that's not a question of ethics either, and meaning, and I am an Austrian economist and all of that, but what's keeping the Fed from just start printing a bunch of money to provide that liquidity? And are they doing that now because they see this?
Well, I think that's a great question. I can't answer that exactly. I would say that partly it's inertia. It's the fact that they, there was a recent speech by Lori Logan, who used to run the SOMA account, which is basically the Fed's balance sheet, or the treasuries that are on the Fed balance sheet go into something called the SOMA account. If by the way, if anyone's If there's anyone who enjoys reading novels, and you look back to, I think it's, is it 19, 1984, I think it is, where they had SOMA, or was it Brave New World? Only one of those, one of those science fiction books about dystopian futures. They had SOMA, which was the drug, wasn't it, that people used to take to keep them quiet. And the Federal Reserve's Treasury account is nicknamed SOMA. So somebody with a sense of humor in the acronym department of the Fed came up with that name. Anyway, going back to Lori Logan, she said that very recently, more or less summarized to say, if you're going to make an omelette, an egg omelette, you can't do that without breaking eggs. And omelette is getting bank reserves down, and the breaking eggs are the disruption or turbulence in the repo market. So the Fed is kind of alert to these problems. I think what I read is they're kind of, they're going to try and tough it out. Now, is that a good idea? Well, ask me in 3 months' time. I don't think it's a great idea, but this is the policy that they seem to be adopting. And one of the issues is, in the background, there's Scott Bessent and others in the administration who are saying, look, it's now Main Street's turn. Wall Street has had its run, and Wall Street basically has benefited because of Fed QE. And Fed QE is a hose, Chairman Powell holding a hose and just soaking everyone, and all asset markets are going up, thanks very much. But Main Street's losing out. So what we've got to do now is to stop this Fed QE because it's really unfair and it's creating, rifts in society. And what you've got to start doing is creating what I've dubbed Treasury QE, which is basically an alternative, but it requires the Treasury to fund itself through bill issuance, very heavy bill issuance. Now, the advantage of that is that you can direct that spending through, government outlays into where you want, like defense or strategic minerals or whatever it stakes in Intel or whatever the choice is. It can be very directed spending. The disadvantage is that as you transition from Fed QE to Treasury QE, your money market liquidity is going to shrink, your bank reserves are going to shrink, and you're going to get a lot of tensions in the repo markets, which are fundamental to the funding of Wall Street. And that's really the question. So maybe this is deliberate, maybe this is accidental, but the fact is, it's going on.
Got it. So about that point, Treasury QE directive. So I want to ask the question. So what you're talking about is like the government specifically making an investment, whether that's Intel, whether that's a tech company, or whether that's a mining company, like you mentioned, strategic minerals or whatever have you, correct? Okay.
Exactly.
So then you're getting, and I'm going to use the word inflation. I'm not sure that's the correct word, but then you'll have direct inflationary pressure, if you would, in specific markets. So that would be, again, in the strategic minerals market, or that could be in the tech sector or whatever, correct?
Yeah, absolutely correct. Now, you see, I think that then you've got to look at the differences that, what's important in terms of understanding inflationary pressures is which circuit or which pool the liquidity injections go into. Now, if they go into financial markets, you get inflation, but that's asset price inflation, and we think of that as being a good thing. If you get money going into the real economy, we get, Main Street inflation, which everyone deems to be a bad thing. I mean, clearly, quite rightly. And so it depends where the money is going. And if money is leaving the financial system and going into the real economy, then you're going to get a shift from asset price inflation towards consumer price inflation. And that's really the risk. Now, you mentioned that, there's a lot of monetary financing going on. Well, there is. And the fact that the Treasury is using bills is very important to understand, because the question to ask is who buys the bills? And the fact is that banks tend to love bills, and we know that the Federal Reserve is actually getting an appetite for them because the Fed itself says it's going to start buying bills. But any purchase of government debt by a credit provider is monetization of the deficit. I mean, Milton Friedman would be turning in his grave right now if he was doing this. And this is what's going on. So the marginal growth of money in the US is coming out of monetizing the federal deficit. We know that never ends well.
So I want to talk about that. It doesn't end well, but it seems like by, and I've wrote all this down, treasury quantitative easing with the government, if you would, the treasury picking what industries they're going to invest in, if you would. They're really picking the winners and the losers in this, correct?
Yep.
Okay. So, gosh. And so the second question is really, I mean, is this just like, I don't want to get too political, but is this just like political? Hey, you're my friend, you donated to me, so now I'm going to support the cause? Or, I mean, where's the danger here, obviously? I guess that's a better question.
Yeah, I think, look, I mean, I wrote a book, I mean, it's about 5 years ago now, called Capital Wars, which was basically looking at the whole idea that there was a struggle for the dominance of capital in the world economy between America and China. And we went through a lot of this liquidity stuff and why, watching global liquidity is important. But the book was really designed to say, look, there's a lot of talk about trade wars, but trade wars are just a veneer here. I mean, you've got to go beneath the surface. And what really matters is capital wars. And the dominance, the idea that you need to get your capital or your currency dominant. And effectively, yeah, we're in a war period now. There is a war, but America and China are creating war economies, okay? And basically, the economic models that both countries are remarkably similar.
I
I mean,
was going to say that.
state capitalism,
Yeah.
the government sectors are taking a bigger bite out of their economies. And you know, the question for both economies independently would be, is if government spending in China and government spending in the US stopped, wouldn't both economies be thrown into recession right now?
Yes. Yeah, I was going to make that point and you brought it out. So this is remarkable. What you're saying here is actually remarkable, very similar, remarkably very similar to China, correct?
Yeah, I mean, less than what, too carried away, but I mean, the whole idea that China is a conventional socialist economy is clearly nonsensical. I mean, they have no welfare system. I mean, America's got more of a socialist welfare system than China has, let's face it.
Yeah.
And China's got a very, very regressive tax system where the consumer is taxed very heavily. And so you could argue that the US, which is taxing income and wealth, is actually a more redistributive system, and so therefore more socialist in inverted commas. So the whole idea that China is some sort of communist paragon is pie in the sky here.
Right.
It's a state capitalist country, society, or a state capitalist model, and they're running the economy with the idea of the goal here is dominance. They want to displace the dollar as the main currency worldwide, and they want to challenge America. I mean, that it's as plain as simple as that.
Yeah. Okay, so talk about that a little bit. So they want to challenge the dollar and really challenge American dominance here, US dominance here. How are they going to do that? Because again, I see, I get it, like we're printing so much money that the dollar is going to go down, but it's all relative, right? Because every single country out there is printing a lot of money, and everybody, the dollar has really the only infrastructure. And again, please correct my flawed logic if it's flawed. Has the infrastructure really for global trade, right? I don't see the
Correct.
yuan or the Russian ruble or the BRICS, if you would. Do they really have the infrastructure to replace the dollar for global trade? That's my question number one. The next question is, where does gold come into all of this? Because gold has been on the tear and central banks have been, it looks like stacking, buying up a lot of gold.
Yeah, I mean, these are really good questions, and they sort of come to the heart of the problem. Andy, so if you let's sort of step back and think about these two monetary systems. The US system, the dollar-based system, was originally founded on gold at Bretton Woods. It was a gold exchange, effectively a gold exchange standard. But let's say after Nixon took the US dollar off gold, the backing for the US dollar was principally US treasuries. So, if you liked, it was a sort of treasury standard, which really meant that ultimately the US had to control inflation. And that was, that's really been the history of the last few years. And the more that the treasury market looks weak, in other words, the more that you've got debt accumulating, prospectively, the weaker the US dollar is. So, what you've got to do is continue to try and shore that system up. And the way that Scott Bessent has sort of decided to do that, as far as I can see, is one route is via stablecoin, and that is basically saying that if you're issuing stablecoin, you've got a ready new market for treasuries. They're going to issue a lot of bills, they being the treasury. That makes it easy for them to fund the deficit. They can then direct that spending quite easily, and what's more, banks and stablecoin issuers will actually buy up a lot of that short-term debt, and so you can kind of square the circle that way. So give another lease of life to the dollar, and I think that makes huge sense. The other thing that comes through alongside that is that stablecoins are a threat to other financial systems,
Yeah.
particularly the European system, and the Europeans have sort of squeaked foul several times about this is very unfair, but hey, that's life, I suppose. It looks, stablecoin look quite attractive if you're a European, I would suggest. And the other country, or the other area which really gets hurt, is China. And I think the Chinese have been particularly spooked by the prospect of stablecoin, because they could lose control of their monetary system if you get an exodus of capital. And clearly, even though China's got capital controls, it's very leaky, particularly if you're running big companies. You can keep money, you can get money out. And if that money goes into stablecoin, then the Chinese lose a lot of control of their system. So the Chinese have actually started to, in my view, this is my interpretation of what's happened this year, have actually decided that they're going to repair what has been an impaired financial system, impaired with debt over the last a few decades. Now, I'm going to show you a chart which is a contrast to this one, which is the world. And given the fact this is advanced economies, let's say this is a pretty good proxy for US debt to liquidity. So the US is similar, pretty similar to that picture. Now let's look at Japan and China, which is sort of up here. So this is the debt liquidity ratios of Japan and China. Now, if you look at the black line, that's Japan. Don't worry too much about the percentages on the side. They're different measures. They're measures of the debt liquidity ratio. They differ between the two countries. And that's what that only reflects the different term structure of the debt. But so don't worry about that. You've got to look at the history, the pattern over time. And the black line is Japan. You can see that the debt liquidity ratio, basically over that time frame, what tripled from 100% to 300% debt to liquidity. Big numbers. Saddled the Japanese economy, weighed down heavily on it. Japan couldn't really perform. They had to get rid of that debt. You can't default debt within a financial system because it is the collateral. So you've got to devalue it somehow. So what the Japanese did is pursued this policy of Abenomics. They got the BOJ to buy lots of JGBs, Japanese government bonds. They effectively printed money. They monetized that. And ultimately, the debt liquidity ratio has come down. And the Japanese economic performance has picked up correspondingly. Now, roll on 15 years, and China is about 15 years behind what happened in Japan. And it looks pretty similar, doesn't it? The orange line.
Yes.
And what you're getting now is the Chinese are monetizing their debt. And they are trying to get their debt down. They want to get the financial system rebuilt or made more robust. And what they're doing is printing money aggressively to do that. Now, simultaneously, they're buying lots of gold. And that gives them a cushion in terms of this monetization. And what it means is, sorry, what it means is that number one, they're putting a lot of liquidity into their markets. Evidence this chart here, which is looking at People's Bank of China liquidity injections. This is a 6-month change, but they put in, let's say, over the
That's
last
a
12
hockey
months.
stick up.
Yeah, it's basically they put in the last 12 months, they put in about $1 trillion equivalent into their
Yeah.
system. Okay, they're going to have to do the same again. So I think that my figure is about 2 trillion is probably what's needed to start addressing the problem. Now, that means that they should be devaluing their currency.
Yeah.
I would argue they are. And the way to look at that is to look at the yuan gold price. And I think that's the best metric to understand what China's doing here.
There you
So what
go.
they're doing is, broadly speaking, letting the yuan gold price appreciate. Now, given the fact that they're encouraging their citizens to buy lots of gold, is clearly propelling this higher at the same time. But it's giving Chinese investors or residents a big cushion against that monetary inflation.
Yeah.
And what's more, if China backs its currency to some extent by gold, I'm not talking about a gold standard here, that's not what I mean. A gold standard is impossible. But what they're doing is they're putting a higher gold content against their currency. Now that gives them the facility to do a lot of gold oil maybe or gold copper trades with big suppliers. And they could actually allow, for example, selectively the Saudis or the Emiratis or the Brazilians to say, okay, we're going to do a trade deal with you, but it's going to be swapped for gold, and you can basically trade your gold through a gold exchange, Shanghai or wherever you want. But effectively, you can have this gold. Now that gives China effectively a monetary system which, although the paper yuan is devaluing to get their debt burden down, they are backing their system increasingly with gold, and it gives them, if you like, a sort of semi gold-backed currency, and that's the collateral that China is really veering to. So what you're looking at is a world economy that is cleaving into two bits. China is accumulating gold. I mean, last year, if my figures are correct, they bought about 750 tons in the open market. They produced about half that again. So they're increasing their gold stock officially at about 1,000 tons a year, which is, as you know, big numbers. If the US has got 8,000 tons in Fort Knox, it's not going to take long for China to start to eclipse that. So this is clearly real and it's very important. What's the US doing alongside?
That's what I was going to ask. I bet you they're doing the same thing. I'm interrupting
Well, I
you, but go
think,
ahead.
I don't think the US is necessarily accumulating gold. I mean, they may be. It'd be a welcome thought if they did. But I think what they're doing is they're creating collateral against that, against the dollar. And that collateral is basically increasingly digital currencies. So you've got an alternative. These are both monetary inflation hedges. And I think you can argue that maybe, I mean, okay, China's got history on its side with gold, but maybe the US has got the younger
Generation one.
generation on its side who understand the crypto and digital world. But effectively, this whole idea of stable coin and the effectively stable coin or owning treasuries is the way that the dollar is being backed, in my view.
That is fascinating. To all my viewers and listeners, the last 10 minutes, Michael just tied it all together. That is fascinating. That's In other words, the US and China more than likely doing the same thing, but in a different measure or with a different asset, correct?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's all about the
Wow.
modern financial system is all about collateral, understanding collateral.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, well said. Well done. Okay, so we are actually running out of time here. Let me ask you this. Let's land the plane here. If there's anything my viewers and listeners you'd like to leave them, what you expect from now until the end of the year or going into the first quarter of next year for them to look out for or for them to watch, what would that be and what should they be aware of?
Okay, I'm going to leave. I'm going to give you this thought. And the main thought is you've got to distinguish trend from cycle. Okay, very important in investment. Think about what the trends are, also to recognize the cycles. In my view, there is a risk that we're dipping over in the roller coaster cycle. That's for sure. So you want to trim, in my view, extreme risk positions. As I said, and I've probably made the point a couple of times. There's a fire alarm sounding. I don't know whether this is a test or the real thing, but we're going to see in the next few weeks whether that is. But I think there's a case for being prudent. I think the liquidity cycle may be topping, but hey, let's see. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. But if you come back to the trend, let's just go right back to the beginning of the presentation, which I don't think I showed, which is basically looking at where are we? This chart.
Gosh.
This is looking at now. This is Congressional Budget Office data, so bipartisan organization, pretty neutral, actually quite conservative. The only difference in the figures they produce and our interpretation is that we've lifted defense spend to 5% of GDP, whereas I think they had it at about 2-ish, which seems to be too low. But aside from that, pretty much similar figures. The structural deficit in the US consists of four programs: Social Security, Medicare, defense and interest payments. Okay, only those four. No discretionary, no infrastructure, nothing like that. Nothing in there for that. Okay, the structural deficit should be actually a structural surplus, broadly speaking, for a prudent administration. And if you look back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, maybe early part of the 2000s, you saw that. Okay, so a structural surplus, which means a negative number on that print on the left-hand axis. Then you started to see problems. GFC, big spike around 2009, 10. COVID, another big spike.
Yep.
But then you see this secular trend in the structural deficit, which is being lifted largely for two reasons. One is the increase in welfare spend in the US. And whatever one may say about the generosity or not of that scheme, it's clearly costing the taxpayer a lot of money. And on top of that, you've got the compounding effect of interest And we know that, interest has a nasty tendency to compound and just raise debt levels. The dotted line is the debt to GDP ratio on that right-hand scale. So, we're saying 250% of GDP by 2050. The Congressional Budget Office actual figures are not dissimilar from that anyway. So, we're dancing on the head of a pin about those sort of numbers. Now, these are scary figures. Will it happen? Well, why not? Japan's got over 200% debt to GDP. I mean, they're still waking up every morning and, walking around and working. The real question is, how is it funded? And the question is, or the reality is, it's always funded ultimately by printing money. And that's the reason that debt is bad. Now, this chart is another one to look at, which is taking that
Jeez.
same data, the dotted line, and it's saying this is debt to GDP held by the public, okay, on that scale on the right. And the orange line is the gold price. And all we've done is to say, well, okay, why don't we fix the total amount of debt in the US in gold terms? Fix it in gold terms. So it doesn't, so it's, you've got a constant real value. What would the gold price have to do, if that was the case, to basically keep debt and gold constant? And that's what you see, read it off. So we're currently around $4,000 an ounce, okay? By the mid 2030s, you're up at 10,000. By 2050, you're up at 25, $25,000 an ounce.
Good
Now,
God.
okay, people will say, well, of course, this is fanciful, this is ridiculous, it's not going to happen. Let me just go back for the previous 25 years. Previous 25 years, US federal debt increased by tenfold, right? From 2000 to 2025. It's now about $29 trillion. Okay, marketable debt in the hands of the private sector, 29 trillion. So it's gone up 10 times in 25 years. How much has the S&P gone up? It's gone up 4.7 times, right? Pretty good return, people think, but actually it's lagged the debt increase. How much has gold gone up? 13 times. So gold has more than matched the increase in federal debt, and all we're asking for here is to match the increase in federal debt.
Got
So
it.
it's not fanciful, it can happen. And that's why we've got to think about monetary inflation hedges in our portfolios. And you can choose, you can have gold, you can have silver, you can have Bitcoin, whatever crypto, but these are monetary inflation hedges. You can think of prime residential real estate, that's always been a good monetary inflation hedge, but we've got monetary inflation hedges. And I think, right as I said right at the beginning, I mean, monetary inflation is not the same as Main Street inflation, because you get things which interfere. And people will say, well, okay, we've had a lot of monetary inflation in the last 25 years. So hang on, why didn't we get Main Street inflation? Well, the answer is two reasons. One is China, because China dumped a lot of cheap goods on the US Main Street. And secondly, you got AI or whatever, or productivity gains from technology. And that caused costs to come down. And oil prices, of course, are a fraction of what they were in 2008. So, broadly speaking, these are the factors that have depressed costs and kept Main Street inflation low. But asset prices are much more about monetary inflation, and that's what we're seeing. In the next 25 years, we're going to get monetary inflation. Will you get the China cost deflation? I don't think so. Will you get AI deflating costs? Well, that's a moot point. I don't know. I'm not that smart to tell you, but it's possible, of course.
Okay, Michael, we'll end on there. If people want to read your work or do business with you, how do they do that?
Well, the best way, I think, is if you're an investor, you can look at Capital Wars, which is a Substack, and that we write, two, three times a week, both narrative and giving data on what we see happening. And we've got an institutional service, which is basically largely providing data through a vehicle called, as you can see on the chart name, GLI Global Liquidity Indexes. And we provide a lot of data, and we've just devised a nowcasting system that will actually provide data on a daily basis.
Excellent. Michael, I want to thank you so much for your graciousness and coming on with me. Again, I'm a huge fan, big follower of yours. I have been for years, so I want to just thank you for that. And I will link to everything that you said in the show notes, both on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify podcasts.
Well, that's great. Much appreciated and enjoyed it.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you.